You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 242 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I'm in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of 2020 NFC West champions, Seattle Seahawks.
Hello. It is Hello. A semi-emergency pod. We did not have time to record immediately after the game, but we knew we wanted to record tonight because we wanted to get the final weekly pod of 2020 out early, and then coming later this week. Be sure to check out our 2020 year in review and 2021 bold predictions.
Maybe my favorite podcast that we do all year.
100%. I'm actually much more excited to do that podcast.
Legit looking forward to recording it. Because you generally remember what your bold predictions are. I have no idea what I boldly predicted.
I don't know what you boldly predicted either, because I didn't write it down in the notes. I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to figure that out.
There it is.
What I know is that one of my bold predictions was proven wrong today.
There we go.
Because it was that the LA Rams were going to win the NFC West. And the process was not bad on that. But the outcome was way wrong. Because the Seahawks had it all the way. We should toast to this NFC West division championship on the semi-emergency pod. And fittingly for the final pod of 2020, we have a beer to celebrate the end of this horrific year and look ahead to 2021. It is the Stone Enjoy by 1121 Unfiltered IPA.
Do you have anything to tell us about this beer, other than that we'll be enjoying it by 1121?
I have to tell you, I had to go look it up on the website because it's not in the bottle, that we have 5 days, as we record this, 5 days, 3 hours, 24 minutes, and 50 seconds left to enjoy this beer before 2020 comes to an end. I assume that's on the does that check out? No, I guess that's not the correct Pacific time at the moment. So anyway, although it's very similar to our regular version of Stone Enjoy by IPA.
What does Stone Brewery know about Pacific time?
Well, leaving the beer unfiltered results in a perceptible change with the hop aroma. It is more fruit forward than our filtered version, which has more of a balance between dank and fruit. It's a little challenging to brew since we're used to filtering our beers, but a fun one with much of the same hop intensity as our original version.
All right. Well, our final regularly scheduled podcast toast of 2020 goes to the Seattle Seahawks. We'll have so much more to talk about recapping what was a very interesting year in sports later on this week. I'm genuinely fascinated to talk about this year, both from a Seattle perspective and a little bit from a national perspective, and just what it meant and how those things influenced Seattle, because obviously the strangest year of our sports lives.
Without question. And we'll have some more toasts coming later in the pod, but for now we want to talk about this Seahawks-Rams game. Well, it is fresh in our memories. The Rams' Christmas celebration, their Christmas vacation-inspired celebration, ruined by the Seahawks.
That was very strange. There was that, and then there's the ad that they showed earlier in the game,
Right beforehand. It was the commercial break before that, so it was clearly some synergy there. Some
yeah, it was the Christmas vacation songs going on. I had no idea. And I will tell you that the Rams offense came out today looking as stiff as Chevy Chase did in that ad.
Oh, wow. Wow. Jared Goff showed slightly more mobility, I would say.
Not much. And he was scrambling out there. I mean, this was a game that I feel like some of the stakes were taken away from a little bit early on. And then throughout the day, all of the stakes came back. And we're going to talk about what this game means. But really understanding the main thing to me was Ben had tweeted, does it really matter if the Seahawks win this game?
That's Ben Baldwin, their Pelton brother.
Obviously horseshit. But
First off, you always want to beat the Rams.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's that aspect of it. But the other thing is you want to put yourself in the position that if other unexpected things happen, it benefits you. And that's where the Seahawks have now put themselves. They're in the position that if unexpected things happen down the road next week with the Saints or the Packers, it could benefit the Seahawks. It's not a situation where we're going to be looking back and kicking ourselves and saying, ah, if we only won that one game. We can still go back and do that about other games throughout this year, but not from this one. And I think that's what made this such a huge victory. Also, to come back to it, being the NFC West champions is something that, you know, it's going to hang on a banner. They're going to play another home playoff game. It's not going to be a home playoff game in front of fans, but this is something we haven't seen for quite a while. And to me, the other big takeaway from this game was, for better or worse, this looked like the Seahawks that we saw last when they were playing a home playoff game.
I buy that. I mean, one of the things you could say is if you go back to the 2017 season, the changing of the guard in the NFC West was the Rams coming to Seattle and just destroying the Seahawks defense and making them look super slow in a way that they did again last year. And even though the Rams haven't continued necessarily winning the division, because obviously last year it was San Francisco, that ended the Seahawks run atop the NFC West. And this is their first championship since then. They've gotten back.
Oh, it was a thing of beauty. I mean, we talked about, you know, you remembered vividly each time that the Rams have destroyed the Seahawks. And this was a game where all of Sean McVay's bullshit didn't work. Maybe a couple of throws. But this wasn't like...
It wasn't even really Sean McVay bullshit that worked. Like, you know, me, it was
there were a Cooper couple Kupp times. Cooper Kupp getting open for third downs. That's a little bit Sean McVay bullshit.
But he just does that. That's just Cooper Kupp being a good receiver. I don't count that as Sean McVay bullshit.
It was one of those games, though, where you looked at it and you're like, what is wrong with the Rams? We see this against other teams, but we never see this against the Seahawks. And we finally got to, maybe for the first time since Jared Goff's rookie season, got to see one of those games where you're just like, wow, whatever's going on over there is messed up. And that's what you want to see from the Rams, because we see it week in and week out against other, not really, but we see it often against other opponents, against the Jets, against the Dolphins, against the Niners, and it never seems to happen against the Seahawks. And this one time, it finally fucking happened against the Seahawks.
I mean, we've seen it happen about half the time during the second half of this season. We talked about this last week that, you know, he basically since including, I can't remember if this was since the Seahawks game, but he had like three good performances, four bad performances, and one blah performance. So like, you know, this is not an uncommon sight, suffice it to say at this stage. I mean, there've been some mediocre Jared Goff games against the Seahawks, I would say, since then. Yeah, maybe not. I guess that's not really true. It's been pretty consistent. He's been over 8 yards per attempt every meeting against the Seahawks.
He's been significantly better against the Seahawks than he's been probably against any other opponent in the league.
He's gotten more opportunities to do it. I bet there's, you know,
he's been significantly better against the Seahawks than he's been against the rest of the NFL.
Yes.
And it has been so frustrating to see. And you're like, this fucking guy, right? The person who has our number is Jared Goff, right? Like, you're just like, that's not, if it's whatever, if it's Aaron Rodgers, if it's Pat Mahomes, you know, that's one thing. But it's Jared Goff is the dude who breaks down your defense. Like, there's got to be something wrong with your defense. And, you know, the people who pay attention to tape a little bit more will be able to look at why things were different today. But I think this was the type of game where, you know, we see this against the Seahawks offensively. You get so frustrated where it's like they know exactly what we're going to do. They're always in the right place. And this was a game plan where we saw Jared Goff scrambling a lot. They were just like, run, Jared Goff. You know what? We're not going to come off these receivers and let you throw easy passes. We're going to let you make plays with your legs, even if it means you're going to go into your slide way before the first down. Like,
maybe especially.
This we want to see Jared Goff do it himself. And I think he proved that he's not capable of doing that. And maybe this is a template that other teams have set up for the Seahawks, and they were able to copy with their game plan this week, but they executed it phenomenally.
Well, I mean, I think there was a bit of a long con there where, you know, Troy Aikman mentioned this in the broadcast, that they wanted to use a lot of multiple tight end sets, which is something the Rams do much more often this season than they have in the past. But because they wanted to keep the Seahawks in their base defense, thinking that a more favorable matchup. And in this case, that was not a more favorable matchup,
yeah,
it turned out.
I do not agree with that. I mean, Michael Kendricks is not walking through that door.
It's nice to
see Jordan Brooks on the field.
Yeah, I still don't know if that was the best use of a first-round pick on an off-ball linebacker, but one of the things the Seahawks wanted to do, as I just mentioned, they look slow a lot of the time against the Rams in the past. And you add Brooks, you add Jamal Adams to this defense, when you cannot say that they look slow.
Yes. Good Lord, Jamal Adams. But the drive to me that really stuck out. So, I mean, we could go through it maybe generally in periods of time. And obviously this was the most crucial drive of the game, but the stop at the goal line was the most Pete Carroll bullshit. Like
every blade of grass.
That is a Seahawks defensive play coming up with a huge stop at the 1 yard line, like a touchdown saving tackle. Was that not Earl Thomas out there making that play coming through? I mean, the only difference is that he was rushing the passer when he was doing it. Earl Thomas wouldn't have been doing that. But the speed and the closing ability and making sure that you get the stop before the end zone, it's like that is a Pete Carroll safety right there in Jamal Adams.
And that was the same end where they stopped Cam, right? Like, yep. Where this wasn't the end of the game, but all these crucial plays this season have happened, it seems, in that end zone.
I think that was the other end zone. I think it was the other end zone. I think this was on the north side, and the Cam play was on the south side.
Cam play was on the north side.
I'm pretty sure that the Cam play was on the south side.
All right. Well, so much to strike that note then. It was definitely
Lot of massive stops at the goal line if it happened on the south side of the end zone, though.
It was definitely the same side as the end of the San Francisco game last year.
Oh, yes, it was.
So there you go.
I want to come back to some synergy for that in a little bit.
By the way, also it was the most Pete Carroll bullshit because of that challenge on third and goal of the Jared Goff fumble where there was no evident recovery whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. No, it had the whole Pete Carroll experience. It had everything you could ever want from a Pete Carroll game. Down to when the Rams, when they ran the ball on fourth down, it was just like, praise the Lord. Like, Pete Carroll, I don't know if he Jedi mind tricks teams into doing this or whatever. Them running every single play on that series once they got to the goal line was just like, you're gonna come at us with exactly what we're going to be best at. And that is stopping what we think you're going to do. Any bit of motion. Like, if they get a tight end leaked out, that motherfucker is going to be so wide open. Right? We don't care if it's an eligible lineman, a running back, a tight end. They would have caught a touchdown in the end zone with 6 yards around them in every direction. But the Rams said, we are pounding the rock here. And that's what Pete Carroll excels at stopping.
Yep. I mean, I think the other part of it in terms of why they were willing to run is, as you mentioned, they probably don't trust Jared Goff right now. And the other key play in this game before that stand was the Quandre Diggs interception with the Rams leading 6-3, driving, you know, one of their better drives of the game, first and 10 at the Seahawks 29. Is a situation where at the very least you're expecting them to put 3 points on the board and probably 7 and make it a multiple score game, which the way the Seahawks offense was playing at that point would have felt like a lot to come back from. And it's just an inexplicable pass attempt from Jared Goff.
Yeah, I mean, it was really kind of similar to the one that we saw Russ make earlier in the year, which was that the Bills game that he threw that terrible pick.
That was the one in the end zone, yes, if that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah, where it looked like he had a mile to run and then he just flipped the pass. I mean, Goff probably had an open receiver and just missed it by an incredible amount. That was what it reminded me of. And can I also just say as an aside, I was thinking of this today. I think Troy Aikman throughout this year has become an excellent broadcaster. Like,
it's woke Troy Aikman.
I think Troy Aikman has He really, like, this year we've gotten the emergence of Aqib Talib, which is a beautiful thing to see. We've gotten the normal, like, base level of quality that you get from people like Romo. And I'm not as much of a Chris Collinsworth guy as you are, but Troy Aikman this year, he's somebody who I always felt like was the type of person who just did the base, like, you know, oh, this is a big play, shit like that. You know, just like the most bland thing that you could possibly say. I have been so impressed with having Troy Aikman on every single broadcast that he's been on this year.
I think Troy Aikman and Joe Buck have been a little obsessed with the Seahawks turnover proneness because they happened to do the game in LA against the Rams and then the Arizona game the next week. But aside from that, yes, Troy Aikman being more aggressive than coaches about going for fourth downs
incredible.
Is an incredible transformation. Yes,
it is really amazing. Oh, this is another random aside. You know, you talk about this a lot about how we dwell too much on going for fourth downs, right? It's all we care about. And sometimes coaches who go for fourth downs, I don't know why I said that with like a Canadian accent, but sometimes coaches who go for fourth downs still are bad coaches. And I feel like you look at sometimes like Doug Peterson's offense, who knows what the talent is like. Cliff Kingsbury is like, Cliff Kingsbury was being aggressive. And you know what? The team still fucking lost to the Niners. Like, their team still loses a lot of games just being aggressive on fourth down. Mike Vrabel, right? Like, not that Mike Vrabel isn't a good coach, probably, but like, just going for fourth downs doesn't mean that you're a good coach. There's so much more to being a good coach than going for fourth downs. It's nice when somebody also does that. But like, watching Cliff Kingsbury, it's like, wow, he's being super aggressive and he calls terrible plays.
Well, I appreciate you for stealing that rant basically from me. Just cribbing my notes.
I'm agreeing with you. You should.
I know. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not stealing your rant. This is an agreement with you, and you're rejecting it.
I'm not rejecting it.
Thing that matters that a coach can do is make fourth down decisions.
Just welcome to the party. The other thing that Aikman brought up early in the game was the Seahawks defense has played very well lately. They haven't been playing very good offenses.
Yep.
We're going to get, I mean, people are like, oh, we're going to know for sure after this Rams game. I mean, I might want to wait until they play a better quarterback than Jared Goff to go that far. But like, I now feel confident going forward about the Seahawks defense.
Yeah, I think there's obviously flaws with this defense, but it at the beginning of the year, the offense was so massively ahead of where the defense was that they weren't. It was a disappointment that they were pairing this defense with this offense, and now the two look pretty complementary to each other. Complementary football, right? Like, you look at it and I think the offense is still ahead of where the defense is, but it's not ridiculous. And if you're going to have, you know, the platonic ideal of an NFL team, reasonable platonic ideal of an NFL team, because you can't expect to have the best offense and the best defense,
we did for those six glorious weeks in 2012. I'll never forget it. It ruined football for me. It was so great.
I mean, look, we had some years where we had a extraordinarily good offense and an extraordinarily good defense and went to consecutive Super Bowls. But like, aside from being the best, easily the best team in the NFL, the ideal situation for an NFL team to be set up is to have one of the best offenses and an average to above average defense.
A defense that can get hot at the right time. That's like the traditional formula that Football Outsiders has been talking about for decades. Like, whatever the first Indianapolis championship team where Bob Sanders was randomly healthy for 1 year and their defense was good.
One Indianapolis championship?
Or there was two Super Bowl teams. They lost the other one. Yes. And this team is defensively hot at the right time. I'm a little more concerned about what that means for their offensive strategy and how conservative they've been. What the defense did today was made up for the fact that the offense was completely impotent for the entire first half.
It was what they tried to do against the Giants. This was the Giants' game plan come to life and successful. And they said,
well, they were facing a weaker quarterback.
And the Washington game, too, to a certain extent. And I think one of the biggest issues that Pete Carroll has is assuming that if your defense is playing well, assuming that your defense will always play well. And that is not going to be true. If your defense has a good first half, it doesn't mean that your defense is going to have a good second half.
But eventually they found enough offensively They finally hit one.
If they don't have that drive at the beginning of the third quarter, it doesn't fucking matter what the defense does. And they didn't have that drive in the Giants game.
It might not matter. They were taking deep shots, which was a difference from the Washington game, where the only deep shot in that entire game basically was a play that didn't count, the throw to Freddie Swain
and
in the end zone.
Two very good defenses in a row.
I mean, it's understandable they took this strategy, playing not only two very good defenses, but two excellent pass rushes. We did see, you know, Russell Wilson did not have all day on third down to throw, but on early downs, they were able to generate some deep shots and finally hit one of those up the sideline to David Moore. And that sets up the first touchdown of the game and puts the Seahawks ahead.
When he flipped that ball, were you excited or scared? Because you saw the daylight that he had in front of him.
Oh, scared. I mean, it's third and eight. You should have just taken the first down. It was actually a terrible decision. The process was bad, but the outcome
was outstanding.
It wasn't
even that. And like, when you're watching it, it's like, there better be somebody so wide open down there that it warranted throwing this pass right now. And there really wasn't. But David Moore went up and made the play. And Russ put the ball in a perfect place.
And Moore did a great job of staying in bounds on that one. Yes. So, yeah, I mean, terrific execution all around to complete that.
Really loved seeing Russ hit a deep ball, because it's been a while, and having him he made some pretty questionable throws on deep passes earlier in the game, where there's the ball to DK that he probably should have thrown inside and given DK space to go get. That's not really in Russell Wilson's nature. He throws receivers open a lot. He throws receivers open a lot on the boundary, and right. He does not. This is a good thing that Russell Wilson didn't make this throw, because if you're in the business of trying to throw receivers open across the middle of the field, you're going to throw a lot of bad picks. But so there was that one that he missed. And then there was another deep ball to Lockett that I think he overthrew by like 2 or 3 yards that Lockett, who knows? It's a very long pass. It's not an easy catch to make, but could have probably made a play on.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of got spoiled, I think, early in the season. Like, Russell Wilson is as good a deep ball thrower as anyone in the NFL, but no one is capable of sustaining the level at which he was playing early in the season. And he wasn't sharp for the first half of this game. You know, above and beyond the conservative play calling a lot of the time, he was missing a few throws. And
those are the only ones that I remember him missing as far as that he had some drops on third down.
There was also the ball up the sideline to Hollister. I can't remember what half that was.
That was a defensive holding.
Okay.
Or an illegal contact. It was one or the other. He threw the ball where Hollister was going to be. And in fact, we probably saw toward the end of the game. And Hollister got knocked off his route. It probably was an illegal contact. I'm not giving Russ, until the Truth Monday, we're not even bringing that play up. Because Russ... He made the exact right throw for the situation. And he called it out. They didn't call it.
Do you personally observe Tell the Truth Monday?
I do my own personal Tell the Truth Monday.
With Baby Fantasy Genius?
About every podcast.
Oh, man.
That Chevy Chase joke was probably in bad taste.
Didn't land. Did not land.
He looked very awkward. But that was the only one that really comes to mind. I don't think Russ wasn't sharp. I think he just missed a couple of deep throws, and that's it.
Okay. I mean, this was still a one-score game, even after that big stop at the goal line. The Rams subsequently hit a field goal because the Seahawks went 3 and out on their next drive and ended up punting from their own 2-yard line.
Now, okay, before we... So they punt. Are you going to get to this play? To the fumble and the punt return?
I wasn't going to get to this play. You're the one that's going to want to bring it up, I'm sure.
Did you see the angle that they saw where this was Brian Mooney, right? Who was down with the ball in his possession.
I did not see that, no.
You didn't see this camera angle?
The one from the left side?
From like behind the play, from where the punt happened.
No, I didn't see that angle.
And you could see Brian Mooney with... Look, I'm happy to be wrong here, but it looked to me, I think if the Seahawks challenge this, I think there is a chance that they would have won. I don't think it's a good chance. There's a better chance that they would have won this challenge than the ball, because there was no angle. You could immediately see there was no angle to show recovery on the Goff fumble at the goal line.
Well, they didn't recover it. That's one reason. I mean, there was no angle to show recovery.
They might have recovered it. I don't know.
Goff recovered it.
The NFL puts too much credence into who comes out of the pile with the ball. And I understand that that sometimes is the only way you could do it. This particular play, and the refs wouldn't have known that there was this angle, but if it was reviewed, there was an angle where the Seahawks had the ball and were down. If you have the ball in your possession and are down, that's it. The play's over. You can't take it out of a player's hands after that.
One of my most hated, I'm sure, football takes is that scrambles for the ball should not be allowed. They're extremely unsafe.
You think scrambles for the ball should be allowed?
No, they should be banned.
What are you going to do? When the ball's loose, what? how are you going to get the ball?
Players are not allowed to dive on the pile. You cannot dive on, if you dive on another player, it's a penalty.
That is, okay.
I said it was unpopular.
It's not that it's unpopular. It's that it's like totally against any sort of human nature. You just grab the ball.
Look, I far be it from me to criticize the NFL's targeting rules, but if you want to talk about things outside of human nature, I think the NFL's okay making those kind of rules.
Have there been known to be injuries on piles for the ball?
I don't know if it's like injuries. I don't think anyone's tearing an ACL or anything, but I think they're uncomfortable for players.
I'm sure they are. Okay. But there, also, there's an angle. You know,
Someone who doesn't like to be trapped, the concept of someone jumping on top of me in a pile is makes me distinctly uncomfortable.
You can't put yourself in the headspace of an NFL player with pads on.
In no circumstances.
Look, if you don't want to be trapped, you're not going to be at the bottom of that pile. You're going to be the person who punted the ball, and you're going to be standing 20 yards away from there. You might run at the end and stand.
I'd be pointing. I'd be the guy pointing.
Yeah, you'll be aggressively pointing. I don't think there's any concern that you're going to be at the bottom of an NFL dog pile. But there's an angle, and I think the Seahawks would have had a better chance to win that challenge than they did the goal line challenge.
So this is still a one-score game. Midway through the fourth quarter, the Seahawks take over with 7:20 left in the game. And finally, after 3.5 quarters, they unveil the good offense.
Oh, there's a little bit of good offense. I don't agree with that. First drive of the third quarter, there was good offense.
Third quarter, there was a couple of big plays.
In fact,
I don't think it was
let me push back against you here. How many drives were there in the second half of this game for the Seahawks? I think there were four.
Yes, there were four meaningful drives, not counting them taking a knee.
There were four meaningful drives. One started at the 1 yard line. You can't really blame them for that one. And the decision to throw when you have the ball at the 1 yard line on first down was like, look, there are some times where I think the Seahawks maybe should just run the damn ball. That was kind of one of them. But
yeah, the third drive was the DK Metcalf illegal shift penalty when they were on the move.
Oh man, that was that drive. Okay, I mean, I think the offense had out of the four meaningful drives in the second half, they scored touchdowns on two of them and had beautiful looking drives on two of them. So I don't want to say that this was where they put it all together.
I mean, what I would say about this drive is it's where they found the right balance between getting the ball out quickly, which you do want to do against a team with Aaron Donald, who remains terrifying, but also still attacking up the field. So it's not, you know, dumping the ball to Will Disley in the flat. It's a slant to DK Metcalf. It's play action and then hitting Tyler Lockett on the sideline. Those kind of plays. And so my argument here is, you know, we talked last year a lot about how the Seahawks needed to run the ball early in games so that they could get to the good offense. They didn't run the ball all that well in this game.
They didn't run overall. The ball ever. I mean, there were a few carries. I actually thought Rashad Penny looked like the best back in the game.
But what happened here, I mean, Carson did have a 15-yard run for a first down in this drive, but also being in a situation where they were running clock effectively made play action a threat, even without them believing they had established the run to allow them to do it. And that's why I think we saw the best offense of the game on this drive.
Okay. That first drive coming out of the third quarter was a very good offense.
If David Moore doesn't catch that pass, they go 3 and out. Like I think the margins on that one are a lot closer than you. I guess they had picked up a first down there. But
I think there was a pass to DK in that one also.
Well, No, there was not a completion to DK on that drive. That was the one that ended with the DK penalty. There was a completion to him for a first down.
Horseshit penalty. Okay, so walk us through this drive, though.
So, first and 10, I'm pretty sure that was the play action. That's where they hit Tyler Lockett on the sidelines for 11 yards. And Lockett had not been a big factor in this game up and until this drive, because one of the things the Seahawks seem to have a tough time doing this season is finding a balance between Lockett and Metcalf. And clearly this week, they wanted to make sure that DK wasn't shut out like he was in the Rams game. And that was a very good strategy to take. But you can't forget about Lockett either.
Was this the play? This was the play action that they had where there was tons of space. I think that was a different one later in this drive.
There's two different plays. This is one along the right sideline. He catches it for a first down.
Okay.
The second play is a 15-yard carry by Carson. Amazing. For another first down.
To midfield or so.
Then, and there may have been play action on this, and again, this is Wilson streaking right to left across the field for a 24-yard gain.
To Lockett.
Yes.
This was the play that I think was the best drawn up play of the entire game.
Agreed.
Play action. Russ has tons of time. This is where they broke it down and there were different layers of receivers, which is, you know, really how you should draw up a play. And Russ drops in a fucking dime over the defense. And if you want to say that Russell Wilson wasn't sharp today, just this pass, it like he drops it right over the defense into Lockett out of bounds. It was a beautifully thrown ball. And it was like, if you want to talk about, look, say what you will, Russell Wilson,
he wasn't sharp in the first half.
Okay. Russell Wilson can make every throw. The ability to make this throw is what separates Russell Wilson from every other quarterback.
I don't know if I agree with that specifically.
The touch. Russell Wilson has more touch than almost any quarterback I've ever seen in my entire life.
So then the Seahawks have a run for no gain and a 3-yard completion to Carson out of the backfield. And we're starting to grumble again, but it's yes. 3rd and 7. And DK makes the biggest play of the day on 3rd and 7, catches it short of the sticks,
yep.
And absolutely trucks Troy Reader for a first down.
Because you don't know if they're going to go for it there, too.
Oh, no. You definitely don't. It's so crucial to get that first down.
Huge play by DK.
So that... that gets them down to the 19-yard line. Another Carson run for 3. Then Carson for 3 again. It's 3rd and 4, and that's the Jacob Hollister touchdown up the left sideline.
Last year, we were there at what was then known as CenturyLink Field, the division on the line, Sunday night football against the Niners. And a pass is thrown to Jacob Hollister. And a day late, a buck short, I'm writing the report, and it says a year from now, the Seahawks will find that very same receiver with a better number, and he will score the touchdown that will send the Seahawks to the division championship on a monster play by Russ, by Jacob Hollister. Beautiful stuff here on this play. Such a perfect ball by Russ, hitting Hollister to make the catch. Like, this was... I haven't noticed anybody making the comparison that it was Hollister. It was Hollister a year ago who was a yard away from giving the Seahawks the division to this year. It was Jacob Hollister. We didn't even know if he'd be on the fucking team this year. And there's Jacob Hollister. They signed Greg Olsen. They've got Will Dissly back. Jacob fucking Hollister is there as the one making the play to win the division for the Seahawks. A thing of beauty in 2020.
A rare thing of beauty in 2020.
Lord, right? Has anybody else pointed that out?
I haven't seen them mention that it was the Hollister play both times now. I think Pete Carroll maybe brought up post game that it was the same end zone. Talking about the fourth down stop, though, not
it was
about
the
Hollister
other end zone too. That was maybe I had it wrong.
No, that happened in the fourth down stop and the Hollister play happened in the same end zone. So
did it? Did I have it wrong? Which end zone these were in? The Hollister stop was in the north end zone.
Yeah, those plays were both in the north end zone.
Oh, so this was the north. Maybe I had those reversed.
And also, Cam Newton play was in the north end zone. You're wrong.
I mean, it's different when I'm not at the game and can't see it. It's a lot harder to visualize. I know exactly where it was when Jacob Hollister didn't get that extra 1 yard against the Niners last year on Sunday Night Football. And I know exactly where I was and where I won't be, unfortunately, on the second weekend in January to celebrate what Jacob Hollister did this year to give the Seahawks another division title. Look, playing a home playoff game may not mean what it meant last year, but it is still a beautiful thing to have and something the Seahawks have not had for many years.
The Seahawks have not yet ruled out fans at that home playoff game.
Oh yeah, there we go. I'm going to go ahead and rule out fans, but right now, look, you said, do I have a Tell the Truth Monday? I do, privately. And also, I'm ruling out fans in that game. Right here.
There you go.
Right now. You, wow. You heard it here first.
Exclusive must credit Dalton Gas.
I'm going to take credit for something else later, too, on this emergency podcast. That's it. Beating the Rams feels great.
It does.
Winning the division. Beating the Rams.
I mean, the other thing we should talk about as a takeaway from this game is, and I mean, I don't think that you can divide the game into his performance before and after this play, but we did learn post-game from the NFL Network's Michael Silver that Jared Goff broke his thumb, will most likely need surgery on it, and is most likely out for the season.
It was pretty apparent that Jared Goff was seriously injured. You know, when they kept showing him and he was like, I've not broken fingers before, I don't think, but you don't favor your finger in that way unless it's seriously injured.
Well, it popped out, so it could have just been, a dislocation and associated ligament damage rather than a break specifically. There's a lot of bad things you can do to your thumb, as it turns out.
I mean, I've also popped out parts of my body, and I was not going to be playing football 2 weeks after that, a week after that. We'll see. If I have to give a bold prediction here, Jared Goff will be starting an NFL game in January 2021.
That is a bold prediction.
Because I think he will come back from this broken finger and play in their playoff. Well, I guess I'm not going to boldly predict whether they're going to the playoffs or not. I think that's probably also happening. I do not see the Bears beating the Packers next week. But that leads us naturally to tell us what this victory means. What are the scenarios that are out there for week 17 in the NFC playoffs? What do they mean for the Seahawks?
So the Seahawks at the moment are in the number 3 seed. If everybody, all the division champions, Green Bay, New Orleans, and them win next week, they will stay in that 3 seed. Obviously, they can't go any lower than that because the 4th division champion from the NFC East will be at best 7-9. So,
yes.
They will not be passing the Seahawks.
They're locked into at minimum the 3 seed.
For the Seahawks to move up, they need New Orleans to lose. Because New Orleans and the Seahawks are tied right now. New Orleans is winning that tiebreaker based on conference record. Green Bay also has a superior conference record in addition to being a game ahead of the standings. So if Chicago were to win next week and the Seahawks were to win, that would not push the Seahawks ahead of Green Bay. They would need a three-team tie. They would need both Green Bay to lose. They would need Green Bay to lose and New Orleans to lose, I should say.
So if New Orleans loses and Green Bay wins, or if New Orleans wins and Green Bay loses, New Orleans is 1, Green Bay's 2, and Seattle's 3.
I think that's true, but I thought there was a scenario where the Seahawks get 1, and now I'm not sure what that scenario is.
Isn't it if they both lose?
I guess if the Packers win next week, then conference record would be tied, so the Seahawks wouldn't necessarily lose that.
If the Packers
win. So if the Packers lose next week.
Yes.
They would be 9-3 in conference, and if the Seahawks win, they would be 9-3 in conference.
And
so
what is the
maybe the Seahawks. So I guess the Seahawks could be the 2 seed if Green Bay loses and New Orleans wins.
Okay.
Now I've confused myself.
If both New Orleans and Green Bay lose and the Seahawks win, they're the 1 seed.
I think that is true.
Okay.
Which therefore would imply that the Seahawks would be the 2 seed if Green Bay lost and New Orleans won. But then the 3-team tiebreakers would be, I don't know. I'm confused.
We need Steve Kornacki here. Okay, so let's say that the Seahawks are the 3 seed. That's the most likely place for them to finish, right?
So the scenario right now is they could hypothetically end up in any facing any of the four possible wild card teams.
Lord.
Tampa Bay is the only team that has clinched a play wild card spot so far. Whichever team wins, Rams or Cardinals will be in, and then the Bears will be in if they win, and then if they lose, both Rams and Cardinals are in. So if the Buccaneers win, which they will likely do, they lock themselves into the five spot. They would face the winner of the NFC East. They are playing Atlanta.
Going through opponents really quick. Green Bay is playing at Chicago.
Correct.
New Orleans is playing at Carolina. These are both losable games.
Yeah, they're not gimme games, but still by games no means.
I mean, Green Bay is playing for their, or Chicago is playing for their playoff life here. Like, Chicago has a lot to play for in that game with Green Bay. And Carolina is not a bad team.
They gave Green Bay a run in Green Bay a couple weeks ago.
I look at both of those games, and that's the thing that excites me is, look, the scenario where the Seahawks win, and because also the Seahawks winning, we'll get back to that at the very end of this podcast. Right. That is not granted. That is not a given. But seeing those two teams going on the road and playing against two pretty solid opponents, that, you know, that makes me feel like we're beyond, so you're saying there's a chance territory. And
all of those games will be played simultaneously starting at 1:25 p.m. Pacific. So the Seahawks will not know ahead of time the results of the Packers and the Saints game.
We have Tampa Bay at Atlanta.
No, home versus Atlanta.
Home versus Atlanta. And then we have the Cardinals and the Rams play each other.
In L.A. And as we mentioned earlier, the Bears host the Packers in that must-win game for them.
So let me just give you a scenario here, right? If you can 538 this for a second, try to do it without embarrassing yourself. The Seahawks finish in the 3 seed. The Buccaneers win and the Cardinals win. Who is the 5 seed?
Tampa Bay is the 5 seed. The Cardinals are the 6 seed.
Or sorry, who's the 6 seed? The Cardinals.
The Seahawks host the Cardinals. Most likely they will host the winner of that game. That's the most likely scenario.
So really, by injuring Jared Goff's finger, in one way you're like, wow, okay, we kind of like that because they injured Jared Goff's finger, so they might be playing the Rams again without Jared Goff.
We don't want anyone to get hurt.
No, I'm just thinking about it from a win percentage based viewpoint. But they seem less likely to beat the Cardinals, thus giving the Cardinals a chance at a third visit with the Seahawks.
I mean, I'd rather face the Cardinals than a healthy Rams team for sure. So
it seems like the most likely outcome here will be that the Seahawks face the Cardinals in the first round.
I think that's probably the case.
And then if everything else is chalk, we're getting way ahead of ourselves here. If everything else is chalk, who do the Seahawks face when they go on the road for the first time?
So if that were the case and all the higher seeds won at home, the Seahawks would travel to New Orleans in the divisional round and delay a trip to Green Bay, who would get the bye until potentially the championship game.
And Green Bay would face the winner of Tampa Bay versus Washington?
Well, they would face the lowest seeded team. So yes, if it was chalk, they would face the winner of that game, yes. I don't know how you want to describe that in chalk terms, because Tampa Bay would probably be favored playing at
yeah,
the NFC.
That's chalk. Chalk. Point spread is chalk. Wow. So if the scenario was the Seahawks go at New Orleans, you know, no concern for weather. Obviously, you're playing in a dome. New Orleans, very good defense. Good offense that looks like there's possibly some flaws. And you've got Green Bay playing against Tom Brady. That would be an extraordinarily fun game.
We have gone way too far ahead of ourselves.
But
now.
It would be fun to watch, right? I mean, anyway, yeah, Brady
the
plays
battle,
is going to be
the
fun
battle
to watch,
of the Bays,
right? To be honest, like Brady playing against any team in the NFC playoffs is going to be a fun game to watch because he's just got so much history with every single one of these teams.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. Sign me up. Let's fucking go. January 2021, we've got people getting the vaccine. The vaccine supposedly works against the new strains that are coming out. We've got the NFL playoffs. Fucking Brady. Let's do it. 2021. Let's get after it.
Should we return to our regularly scheduled podcast?
All right, so the next toast.
All right, former Storm three-time MVP Lauren Jackson is among the first-year candidates for enshrinement in the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame in 2021, they announced last week. Other nominees with Seattle ties, former Sonics owner Sam Schulman, the late Sam Schulman, coach George Karl, assistant coach Tim Gergerich, players Dale Ellis and Telvin Skinner, broadcaster Marcus Johnson, and Storm players Swin Cash and Yolanda Griffith.
Who is expected to get in here? This, you named a lot of names. I'm just going to be honest. I've watched Dale Ellis play. Very good player. Probably not a Hall of Famer.
I do not think that he is going to make it in. I don't think... I would say at this point, LJ is a lock to make it in. Yolanda Griffith has a chance to make it in as a first ballot.
Not Swin Cash.
Swin Cash was on the ballot last year and was not a finalist.
What about George Karl?
I don't think George Karl has a strong depth of support after his autobiography.
Wow. Wow. He went too hard in the autobiography, huh?
Yeah, he went too hard, yes.
It wasn't that bad. Come on.
It wasn't good. And the Associated Press coverage afterwards when he was like trashing Dame Lillard for not being a good enough leader because the Blazers like lost a game or whatever ridiculous claim he had at that point. Like, it was not good.
Look, you want to see Dame Lillard as coached by George Karl. Don't tell me you don't.
I want to see Dame Lillard as coached by Terry Stotts. Long time George Karl assistant Terry Stotts.
He's part of the tree.
He is, but then publicly denounced George Karl after.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, so stay tuned.
Marcus Johnson, is he on the ballot as a broadcaster or as a player?
Is a player.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he was a finalist, but was not chosen the year that Jack Sikma and Paul Westfall made it in. So he's got a chance, but it's probably going to be a year for him where there's not a lot of other NBA players who are going to make it in. And I think Paul Pierce is on the ballot among first timers this year. So it's not like that year where there was like basically no first timers of note.
So Yaka is not on the ballot this year.
We'll see. Traditionally, they have announced the finalists at NBA All-Star Weekend.
No, I just meant that's him as a broadcaster.
Oh, right. I see. No, he's not in that role now. Although, I guess, yeah, Paul Pierce is the most notable NBA player as a first-time nominee. So it's not a big class, necessarily, of NBA talent. Is first-time?
Yeah.
There's no one else who's like newly eligible that's notable. He's been eligible for a long period of time. This is guys who retired like 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So
Vlade is eligible as a haircut. Okay.
All right, next up, four UW players named to the All Pac-12 football first team. Of course, tight end Kate Otten.
Hello.
Tackle Jackson Kirkland. Linebacker Zion Tuwola-Fatui and defensive back Elijah Molden, with two more, linebacker Edifuan Ulofosio and cornerback Trent McDuffie, making the All Pac-12 second team.
So. And I definitely a toast to them. I just want to say that I've gone out of my way to say that this college football season was a sham. I've even talked about with Mrs. Fantasy Genius, who is having rabbit problems, as saying that there is a chance that I would even renew my Husky tickets for the future here, right? But I do want to say that none of these issues have to do with these student athletes who,
of course not,
put their health and their lives on the line to play in this season and played their fucking hearts out. All of them. I mean, ZTF, Elijah Molden, Trent McDuffie, what they've done, Jackson Kirkland, like,
Kate Otten?
My heart. Is Kate Otten eligible to come out this year? Is he a junior?
He is eligible.
Go to the NFL, Kate Otten. The Seahawks will draft you. I guarantee it.
Sorry, Jacob Hollister.
If not,
no, there's room on the roster. Greg Olson's retiring.
If not them, so many other teams will draft you, Kate Otten, because that is, you've got what the NFL is looking for. This has nothing to do with the athletes.
Of course. Lastly, this week, we're remembering former Sonics coach Casey Jones, who died on Christmas Day at age 88. A Hall of Fame player, Jones won two NCAA championships alongside Bill Russell at the University of San Francisco and eight more in the NBA with Russell for the Boston Celtics. Later won two titles as head coach of the Celtics before concluding his NBA coaching career in Seattle, first as an assistant to Bernie Bickerstaff and later as his successor, coaching the Sonics to the 1991 playoffs before being fired and ultimately replaced by Carl midway through the 91-92 season. One thing we probably don't give the Sonics enough credit for, from Russell's arrival as head coach in 1973 through Jones's firing in 1991, every Sonics head coach was black at a period in time where that was not common in the league. So,
and then never again.
No, Nate McMillan.
Name it.
Very prominently.
I was going through it in my head. Bob Weiss? They get a lot of points taken away from that hiring.
I would say that, with the exception of George Karl, their most successful coaches, yes. Undoubtedly all black.
No, that's actually very interesting. And I was surprised to see just how old Casey Jones was. I mean, 80.
I mean, he played a very long time ago. He's been retired from coaching for a long period of time. So, you know, he had a full life. So,
we pour one out for Casey Jones.
Speaking of the Sonics, should we talk more about the possibility of expansion in the NBA?
Well, I just want to say, I think that we've got basically two topics that are emergency podcast worthy here on this second ever all emergency podcast episode.
Oh, wow.
I'm calling it right here, right now. The last one ended up with us fighting until like 2 a.m. A lot of chatter around the NBA coming back to Seattle. And I have to say, full page ad in whatever newspaper still exists in the Pacific Northwest. You're welcome. I guilted them into it last week. You know what I said this is what you have to do. A week ago, and the next day after the Pelton Cast episode came out, where I really broke it down for the NBA why the team should be back in Seattle. And all of a sudden there was a lot of chat around NBA being back in Seattle.
I mean, we were talking about NBA expansion. That's why it came up.
Yeah.
It had already come up.
Yeah. What you mean is you're welcome.
Uh-huh. Okay. All right, let's start with here. We've got a series of audio clips, other podcasts that you could be listening to instead of this one, starting with Adam Silver on Jalen Rose's Renaissance Man podcast on Wednesday. Let's take a listen.
What U.S. city would you like to see host an NBA team next?
Again, I try to be a bit politic here. There are a bunch of cities out there that would be fantastic host, but I'm going to say Seattle because I was in this league for many years while Seattle still had a team.
Mm-hmm.
And we were all sad. We understood the circumstances, but we're sad. We were all sad to see. And I know I speak for, you know, David as well, that was just, it was an unfortunate set of circumstances that led to that team leaving. And it still remains a great market. I know I hear from fans of the old Sonics, fans in Seattle all the time. And so there's no doubt when we do turn back to expansion, which we invariably will one day, that Seattle will be at the top of the list.
I echo that and totally agree. Playing against Gary Payton and Sean Kemp in Key Arena was something special.
There we go. Is there another clip that we have?
There are multiple clips. All right, next, Adam Silver went on The Jump on ESPN Thursday.
Adam Silver, he left us on red.
He did, yes. It was asked by Rachel Nichols to elaborate on his expansion comments and had this to say.
I want to switch gears a little bit because you were asked earlier this week about the possibility of expansion, and for the first time in years, you didn't shut the door on it. Adam, you know the glee you caused in Seattle with those comments. I will ask you, how likely would you say expansion is in the near future?
Well, what I said, honestly, was not all that different than what I've said in the past. What I said is it's inevitable that we'll expand at some point. And when asked about Seattle specifically, you know, Rachel, I, of course, was in the league when the Sonics were in town. You know, we didn't make a secret out of the fact that we hated to leave Seattle. But at the time we left, it was clear that Key Arena, the then Key Arena, was not at NBA specifications. And there were no plans on the table to build a new arena in Seattle. And that was whenever, 12 years ago or so. Now we're at the point where there is a new arena, in essence, you know, a rebuilt Key Arena, mm-hmm. that's come online, NHL team going into Seattle. So one, you now have the state-of-the-art arena that didn't exist back then. And I'd say in terms of expansion, it's been a long time since the league expanded. It's not on the front burner. I mean, we're not about to expand at this moment, as you can imagine, just as to your earlier things that are occupying us around the clock. Expansion is not on the top of the list, but we'll turn back to it at some point. And I've said, you know, we loved when we were in Seattle. We've had incredible fans there, incredible, I think, 40-year history of having a team in that market. And there's no doubt there's enormous support there. So at the right time, you know, I think the team owners will turn back to that issue.
And more?
There's one more. This is not Adam Silver. This is my ESPN colleagues on Brian Windhorst and the Hoop Collective discussing the possibility of expansion on last Thursday's podcast episode featuring Tim Bontemps and Tim McMahon.
I would say that I've gone from thinking that expansion in the next 5 years was 10%. I've gone to 51% on this, Bontemps. I now think it's
I think it's higher than that because okay. I think Adam, as we all know, when Adam talks, he doesn't make mistakes, and there has been no walk back from the league or no, you know, turnaround from the league on anything that was reported off what Adam said. And as you guys both know, this expansion thing has been a huge topic of conversation the past couple of days.
I say
no clarifying on it.
I say we're going to have expansion teams in 3 years. The teams will be playing basketball.
By the way, 51% from Wendy, that's like Chuck Barkley making the Garon.
Yep, that's a huge statement.
Now, here's
just
what I'm
going to
say.
Just so people know, there's probably a two-year lag time on when a team is announced to when it plays.
Yeah, so
even
I think
if somebody was announced over the next 12 months, it probably would start till the 23-24 season.
I think a year from now, bids will be in. And 2 years later, we'll have a team. We'll have teams.
I think that's my guess. That would be, I could certainly see that timeline happening. And look, who knows what will happen? Things have been crazy over the past year. Who knows what's going to happen over the next year? But I think the fact that Adam said this and opened the door to it, I think it's very clear that it's something that's on the table in a way. To your point, it hasn't been for years.
Let's fucking go! I don't care if there's not a team playing for 2 to 3 years. We just need the team announced. We need
100%.
We need the team here. I would rather there not be a team because I don't want to see a team losing. I just want to know that there is a team. I want to be in the goddamn lottery. I want to be hiring executives, right? I want to be at the point where they're hiring the analytics staff and we're losing our fucking minds, right? We're like, yeah, that's the best analytics person in the entire NHL, right? That's where we want to be at. We want steam in Seattle, and there's not been steam. I think this may have been a bold prediction of mine that there would not be significant steam toward an NBA team in Seattle a year from now. I have an inkling of a thought about that, and I just missed it by like a week.
You really did. Yeah, I'm so close.
Nobody talked about expansion until last week. Tim Bontemps had to ask the question. But no, this is calculated. This is not Adam Silver and the NBA don't do things for no reason. And I think that's what, you know, McMahon and Bontemps were talking about is like Adam Silver doesn't go on the Jalen Rose podcast, right? Doesn't go on the Jump with Rachel Nichols or whatever the podcast and they don't have this conversation in the Hoop Collective unless this is a real thing. And the reality is I bet these conversations are so much further down the road than we even realize on the front end. These back-end conversations with, assumedly, the NHL ownership group and the money that it's going to be, again, we'll talk about this more, but probably $2.5 billion, is they are probably so much further down than we realize. By the time it reaches the point of the general public even hearing that these conversations are happening.
I mean, I don't know if I would say that, but like Tim Bontemps said on there, Adam Silver doesn't say anything unexpectedly. You know, or he doesn't make a mistake. He knows what questions he's going to get asked. He has a strategy for how to answer them. And clearly a strategy for how to answer this expansion question differed from how he's answered in the past. And I think that suggests that the process is probably even more farther along than he's letting on.
Yes.
Now, we've been down this road before and thought that we had a team.
It's different.
In 2013 and got disappointed.
This is very different. The commissioner is different. B, the arena is there, most importantly.
That's a big thing.
The money is there. We know that. We don't know where it'll come from, but we know that $2.5 billion in an insane turn of events is not that hard to come by. And see, the interest is there.
Yes.
That's it. And those three, and also the openness from the league is there. And I think those four things lining up, most importantly, is the arena. When the arena was done, 1 and 4, when the arena was done and the interest in the league aligned with each other, and I think the pandemic had something to do with this, and the loss of revenue that came from that. When those two points aligned with each other, and the rest of the owners around the league said to themselves, wow, can we go out and get a, not a free $2.5 billion, because it means chopping up part of our TV deals for perpetuity, but it meant, can we ask for more in our TV deals? Because Seattle is one of the markets included, and question mark. And can we go get $2.5 billion and put it in our 30 pockets? Those two points meant this conversation was happening very seriously.
And hypothetically, $5 billion, because presumably the league will expand with two teams when it does expand. What other market that would include besides Seattle is a major question mark of this whole process. That's something that if you want to, if you're interested in, they discussed at length on the Hoop Collective. But
what,
you know,
what was the chatter? Tell me more.
I mean, it's,
this is a podcast about other podcasts.
There's no clear.
Have you ever asked your
city.
Podcast for other podcasts?
Once upon a time, the conventional wisdom was that Seattle
dropping
would get an
quadruple doubles every episode. Thank you. When you're voting.
Oh, congrats again to the famous Cousin Candy for giving us the MVP tweet framed as a Christmas gift.
No congrats are in order.
The conventional wisdom was that when they were ready to put a team in Mexico City, they'd do that and then put a team in Seattle. I don't think they're ready to go to Mexico City yet. So that kind of leaves it in flux as to what the other city it could be. I mean, the candidates are pretty obvious. Vancouver is a strong candidate. Las Vegas, if they want to put a team there, in addition to having the Summer League and a lot of other events there, they're going to have, you know, they have the G League Showcase. They're going to move the Combine there, the Draft Combine. Louisville has an arena. Don't know if they have the money. Nashville, Tampa Bay, the fact that they're hosting a team right now gives them some sort of a foothold with the league. And then either San Jose or San Diego is an additional market in California.
All right.
So
I love it. I love all those options. I mean, I especially love Vegas and Vancouver as options, which would be very exciting to swing some of the balance to the West Coast. And to undo yes. some of the wrongs that have been done to the Pacific Northwest with regards to professional basketball.
Absolutely.
But the main point here is these conversations are happening not unintentionally. This is not a thing that the media is speculating on without the league. This is not something that has been fabricated. Adam Silver is there responding to these questions. And he doesn't need, there's no person who's forcing him to respond to these questions, right? Adam Silver can answer whatever the fuck question he wants.
He very clearly did not answer. Rachel Nichols, I cut it, but her follow-up was, would you bet on expansion within the next 5 years? And he like no commented that in a funny way and moved on, but not the expansion question in general.
You know, he's an attorney, right? He doesn't want to box himself into a corner. He wants to speak very Correct. Generally. The only point that I disagree on, and I think Adam Silver in general has been a very good commissioner. I think he is being very diplomatic by invoking David Stern's name. David Stern did not want basketball in Seattle, and I appreciate Adam Silver.
Stern has said that one of his biggest regret as a commissioner was moving the Sonics and the Grizzlies out of their markets, like having those teams move. He has said that. So I do think it was painful for him, even though obviously he was a driving force in it.
Uh-huh. He's like the hot dog suit, right? Being like...
The hot dog suit?
You don't know about this? Look, we're all looking for the guy who did this. You don't know this meme?
Oh, you're in a hot dog suit and say, okay, that's from the
yeah
Tim Robinson show?
Tim, yeah.
Okay.
Look, we're all trying to find the guy who did this. That's David Stern saying one of his biggest regrets was moving teams out of Vancouver and Seattle. Like, come on.
Okay, fine.
But we're not going to say to Adam Silver, I think you should leave, because Adam Silver, when he came in this league, felt like there was a good possibility that expansion would happen at some point. And do you have any more chatter, though? Before we talk about UW basketball, is there anything more than this? Is there excitement? Are you feeling it on the ground level from the people you talk to?
Yes, but I don't think I have anything else to say.
Wow. Okay. What
if, I mean, I there's nothing specific. It's not that it's like I have something I know that I'm hiding. It's just like you've already got the general concept.
If you had to put a timetable on this, you know, Windy said within the year, if you had to put a timetable on this conversation, what would you put it at?
I don't know anything that would contradict what Windy said.
2021. We it may be announced that the Sonics are returning.
It is plausible that it could be announced in 2021. In fact, it's so plausible that it may not even qualify as a bold prediction to say it at this point.
Wow!
I like, consider that. And I was like, no, it doesn't work anymore.
Hello! Well, I'm fascinated to talk when we talk later this week. I mean, that's very fascinating stuff to hear.
I guess we recognize
the difference between this and Sacramento, right? Like,
yeah.
The most basic thing that the league cared about was, is the arena there?
Well, the arena would have been there if Sacramento had the Kings had moved to Seattle. Like, that wasn't the problem. The issue was they wanted to keep the Kings in Sacramento. There's not
issue. Why did they not want to engage with that group about? Because the group needed the team to make the arena, whereas this other group made the arena.
Correct. I mean, look, if the street vacation had been voted on, I think that it could be the Hansen group that right now is in pole position to get an expansion team.
So, okay, this is another piece of it. And I think we've had such a long conversation about there's these two different groups and we're concerned about one, not concerned about the other. Like, this one is singularly focused on basketball. We don't really care who brings basketball back to Seattle, right?
No.
The games being played, that's what Windy and Bontemps are talking about. It's like,
and that's
basketball
what Chris
games.
Hansen has said. Like, his goal is to bring the NBA back to Seattle.
As long as there are basketball games happening in the city of Seattle, we don't care who's the ownership group. Like, it would be absurd. I don't know who the ownership group is of the whatever, right? Like, I guess I was thinking through teams, and I was like, "Well, I do know theirs. I do know theirs."
I would hope you know the expansion, the ownership group. So ownership is an important factor.
I know
in
the ownership groups of way too many teams, but like, I don't know who owns the Pistons, right? Like,
well, that has been in the news lately. That's a very poor choice. Tom Kors has been getting protested for his investment in a company that handles phone calls from prisons. So,
oh god, of course. Yeah, we can just assume that every single one of them is involved in some sort of evil corporation, Cheesecake Factory or otherwise. But
Cheesecake Factory, but right, I'm taking that out.
You really are? That was a funny joke. Oh, wow, I'm dropping. You're just scared. You're scared of losing the Peltoncast MVP and you're taking out the best content. I understand, but
the most important of all fucking teams, a team that is literally the owner is literally getting protested right now.
The most important thing is that there are basketball games happening in Seattle. We don't really care, and long term, we're not going to care. Honestly, like, ownership is fluid. The team belongs to the city after the ownership.
Well, it doesn't always belong to the team, but sometimes that ownership has to say whether the team belongs to the city. But
also,
yes.
People have learned from the Sonics lease, and you're signing these ironclad leases too. That's the thing where I look at Nash, and I'm like, you got a team in Memphis. Like, come on.
We'll see what happens with the second expansion team. I don't have a good sense for who it is, who it would be if the NBA does decide to expand.
But bringing a team here is the most important thing. And that's all we care about. Being able to go, I mean, I've pictured myself emotionally in that night of it's the first game back as an NBA team. I'm there. The lights are dark or whatever. We've got the lights go down and they're announcing the starting lineups. And it's like, it's a surreal moment. You know, I've been to one or two professional basketball games in the last 4 or 5 years, right? And like, I care about the Blazers, and I think that's the most important part of this. And we'll talk more once the team is actually announced. But
if not once,
I think what the Blazers have done for their service is really incredible. But it's different. I don't follow the Blazers on a day-to-day basis. You know, like you told me that Wenyen Gabriel wasn't on the roster, and I had no idea. You know, I pay some attention, but it's different. You know, it's different also from going 41 times a year and seeing a team. Does
Mrs. Fantasy Genius know you intend to be going 41 times a year?
We've talked about it. Look, it's not a great conversation. I've pushed everything out. I was like, you know, who knows? I was you in that scenario. I said, if. Look, we don't know. I mean, also, the cost is going to be incredible. The cost and the available. I'm just hoping my boss gets good tickets. But the being able to go to NBA games in Seattle is going to be different. You know, it's something that we took for granted for the first whatever couple decades of our lives, and it's something that now we're not going to take for granted, and my children are not going to take for granted. That's the thing. That's the piece that I really feel like emotional about. I don't care about me, you know, like I've been to NBA games. I don't, it just doesn't matter.
I want to be clear. I care about me on this one.
That's like, great. I mean, this matters
to an NBA game without driving 5 hours.
This matters to you on a personal level. It doesn't actually matter. If there's an NBA team in Seattle and I don't have season tickets, it's not going to affect my life. You know? But like taking Baby Fantasy Genius, he's 8 and will be whatever, 11, 12, whatever, if a team were to return on that timetable and will have been to a single NBA game ever and, you know, a couple of football games or whatever. But like we grew up when we were that age, we'd been to hundreds of NBA games.
We got the tickets when I was later older than you were,
but like we'd been to so many NBA games that we took it for granted. And the way that you get to know NBA teams, even if they're bad, that you develop that relationship and that personality with those players is different than any other sport. And I just hope that they're able to, I have 1,000 fucking children. I hope that they're able to do a fantasy draft of 41 games a year and be like, I want this game. I want that game. I want to see the Lakers. I want to see the, you know, whomever it is. Cause that was fun. That was like one of the best days of the year when we were kids, right? Being like, I want this game and I want that game. That was so exciting. And having that Christmas Day, 1996, getting, it was 1996, 95, maybe
95.
Of us getting Kemp and Payton jerseys, right? Like, I don't even give a fuck who it is, right? If it's rookie Obi Toppin or whomever, having a person to be excited about, their future, it's something that we haven't had for 2 decades. He was like, Dad, were you excited about having tickets in Kevin Durant's rookie year? And I was like, no, I didn't give a fuck. I was like, actually, I hated every second of Kevin Durant's rookie year. Because I knew that they were leaving, and that's the saddest part of it, is like that should have been one of the most exciting moments of our sports life, is rallying around a player like Kevin Durant as a rookie, and we had it taken away from us. And I hope that never fucking happens again.
It was still pretty exciting for me.
Was it?
Yes. You loved
watching Kevin Durant as a two guard for 1 year before he played in Oklahoma City?
I mean, the whole year itself was a slog, but the Kevin Durant part of it was exciting.
It was not a second of it. And once they, especially in, what is it, February and March, when they announced that the team was officially moving?
I mean, I think it was after the All-Star game when Stern was like, the team is leaving. Don't try to stop it.
Yeah, yeah. Don't try to stop it. The team is moving. This is the biggest regret of my professional life. Don't try to stop it. I'm going to feel haunted by this forever. Look, when I wake up Christmas Eve, ghosts are going to haunt me about this from Vancouver, Seattle, and Charlotte, I guess. I don't
know. Charlotte got a team back. They're good. I mean, they're not good, but they're okay.
But look, the team's moving. Get over it, motherfuckers. Yeah, yeah. But I'll be haunted by this, of course. Come on. Anyway, I appreciate
it. We're all haunted by different things.
I appreciate Adam Silver and including that as part of this. I understand why he had to. And look, basketball coming back to Seattle would be the most significant thing that has happened in 2 decades.
Well, no, I think leaving happened within the last 2 decades. So I don't know if I go that far. Well, should we talk about UW basketball?
Anyway, speaking of teams that should move.
Mercifully, the UW basketball teams did not play any games last week.
There we go.
Be back in action this week. The UW women on Friday on New Year's Day playing at Colorado, then Sunday at Utah. The Huskies and Buffaloes come in tied in the Pac-12 standings at 1-3. Colorado's lone win came against Utah by 30 points. The Utes are 1-4 in Pac-12 play, having upset Oregon State. Didn't start their season until December 6th due to a positive test for COVID-19 on the roster. Still no word on Tamia Sadler's availability for these games with whatever injury or illness it is she has. UW men's basketball begins Pac-12 play in earnest on New Year's Eve, hosting Arizona at 5 p.m. Then Saturday we'll take on Arizona State at 3:30 p.m. The Wildcats went 6-0 against a non-threatening non-conference schedule. All six games were at home, and their best opponent per Ken Pom was number 130, Eastern Washington. But they did manage to beat Montana, something the Huskies couldn't do, by 6. They lost their Pac-12 opener versus Stanford in Santa Cruz 78-75, and will play Colorado on Monday ahead of the start of the full Pac-12 schedule. Arizona lost 3 starters, Josh Green, Nico Mannion, and Zeke Nagy, to the NBA draft. This year's team doesn't feature that kind of NBA talent. Junior Jamaral Baker, who played off the bench behind Green and Mannion last year, has emerged as the leading scorer, while making 58% of his twos and 46% of his threes so far. The Sun Devils were picked 2nd in the Pac-12 preseason media poll, but are off to a disappointing start. After an understandable loss to Villanova in Bubbleville at Mohegan Sun Casino, they lost 80-68 at home to San Diego State and then 76-63 at UTEP, dropping them all the way from number 23 in the KenPom rankings to start the season number 56 now, 7th in the Pac-12. Their 33% three-point shooting has been a big factor in that. They're also getting badly out-rebounded with a small lineup. Still a lot of talent led by guards Remy Martin and Josh Christopher, both of whom are making better than 60% of their two-point attempts. Martin was a first-team All-Pac-12 pick last season, while Christopher is a projected first-round pick in the 2021 draft.
I can't believe Remy Martin's still on that team.
He's only, I mean, he's a senior, but I'm actually was surprised he was a senior. I thought he was only a junior.
He doesn't feel like one of those players who's been around forever.
I mean, it feels like just yesterday to me that I was watching him at the Les Schwab Classic in the Portland suburbs. Yeah. Yeah, he was on Marvin Bagley's team at Sierra Canyon High School, where Brawny and Zaire Wade now play.
Where's Nico Mannion now?
He's with the Warriors.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he's the third point guard.
Oh, best of luck to him.
Yeah. All right, UW football update. UW freshman quarterback Ethan Garbers entered his name in the transfer portal, joining Jacob Sermon as the 2nd Husky quarterback to do so. As we mentioned last week, that's not surprising given the youth of the UW depth chart at quarterback, with redshirt freshman Dylan Morris is the incumbent starter, in the addition of incoming freshman Sam Heward. Still would leave the Huskies awfully thin at quarterback, with grad transfer Kevin Thompson announcing he will turn pro rather than utilize an 8th year of potential eligibility. Morris and Heward are the lone scholarship quarterbacks on the roster, along with walk-ons Jesse Martineau, Jack Stewardson, and Jaden Sheffy.
You definitely don't like that, you know, that players are playing without getting paid, of course. No, you don't like that having so little depth at quarterback. Like, look, Dylan Morris had a great freshman year, but a lot can happen to a football team, not in front of me, but
I mean, I don't think this is, I mean, look, this is the nature of the quarterback position. If you start a redshirt freshman and have a freshman coming in, like, this is going to happen. And also, if you get down to your, if you get down to your third quarterback, you're probably fucked no matter what.
Yeah. Whomever Jimmy Lake chose as the starter this year, maybe if it was Kevin Thompson, a couple of quarterbacks would have stuck around. But if it was,
I think it would have been different in that case.
If it was one of the three younger quarterbacks, all the rest of them were going to transfer. We knew that. He knew that too.
Yeah. I mean, this can't have surprised them.
You can't blame any of them. I mean, I would never, ever, ever in a million years blame any college football player for transferring, but it makes a lot of sense. Like, they're going to go to a place where they can have opportunity, and Dylan Morris is going to have every opportunity to start every game he wants to for UW.
And Sam Heward might too, so we'll see.
I mean, if you told me in 2 years that Sam Heward was transferring also, I'd say, you know what, that's great that Dylan Morris has had such a good career. Right? Like, he's only a year behind where Dylan Morris is.
That's the other thing, is the fact that none of these guys burned a year of eligibility kind of changed the calculation.
It's just, you can only play one player. Like, that's...
Exactly.
It's a complicated position. And this was a very complicated year, but I think that all of them figured out throughout this process of playing these four games that Dylan Morris was ahead of everybody else, both on the field, you know, and also if he played badly, who knows? But like, Dylan Morris played well, and he played well, and he had the attention and the respect of the coaches, and that meant that he was going to be the starter long term. So this is good. This is good news ultimately for the program.
All right, let's wrap up by previewing the Seahawks season finale Sunday against the San Francisco 49ers in Glendale, Arizona.
Can we, before then, I need to give a TV recommendation.
Do you?
Yeah, I haven't talked about this yet on the podcast, right?
I don't know what you're about to talk about. It's not Ted Lasso, right? You've talked about that.
Okay, so Ted Lasso. I swear to God, so much fun. You just wouldn't have expected it, right? Marcus Mumford.
It was exciting. It was exciting to see Kraken senior quantitative analyst Namita Nandakumar espouse the benefits of Ted Lasso. She came around a little late, but...
You mean everybody. Every single person who started watching Ted Lasso loved Ted Lasso.
As soon as you start watching Ted Lasso, it's all you care about for the period of time you're watching Ted Lasso.
Yeah, no, I don't think... I mean, the two things that I will say... This is not what I was going to talk about, but the two things I will say about Ted Lasso is I think you love it unequivocally while you're watching it, and will not... Like, we'll assume that you're going to watch whatever Ted Lasso comes after it, but it's also not the kind of show that you need to obsess about in a good way. This isn't Game of fucking Thrones, right? You don't need to be on Reddit talking about theories. It's just, it is what it is. And that's a great
show. I mean,
TV
I read
show.
Every single post. I read every single post on R. Ted Lasso, so I disagree.
I have actually read R. Ted Lasso, but there's not that much, right? Like, there's not theories about who Ted Lasso's parents are.
Who Coach Bird really is.
Yeah. It's a good show, and that's it. The show that I want to mention is on HBO Max, and it's called How To with John Wilson. I've talked about this with a couple of other people, and I understand that I'm late to the game here a little bit. Easily, including Ted Lasso, the best television program that I've watched in all of 2020. And
wow. I mean, for me, it's The Wire.
Well, you know, it's also on HBO, so I guess it has something in common
True.
With Wire.
True.
But How To with John Wilson is a documentary show really about, I would say, New York in particular, and has the very feeling of a podcast you're really willing to, God, I wish I remember the name of this one. You start at one place and you end at another place, and you're just so willing to, like, you have these conversations about questions that you can answer of, you know, how to make risotto or whatever, how to make small talk. And you start in one place and then you end up with so much more than where you started. And I think the show in general was like a time machine of going through the 6 months in New York City leading up to a pandemic. And as somebody who was in New York City within that time period, felt pretty haunting. And the last episode, the How to Make Risotto episode, fucking floored me. Like, I loved the show before then, and watching that episode, I was like, God damn it, John Wilson. Like, it's too much. When you get to the end of it, it's funny a little bit, and it's insightful a lot bit, and it really feels like listening to a great podcast, not this one, of course, but to an actually great podcast, where they talk about real things, not sports or whatever. But it was one of the most insightful TV shows that I've watched for the entire year. It's executive produced by Nathan Fielder, who, you know, I've talked to a couple people about the show, and they talked about how Nathan For You is like, Nathan For You is fun and it tries to be funny, but like this hits to an emotional point that is so much deeper than something like Nathan For You. This was the best, I think it's six episodes. It was the best six episodes of TV that I've watched all year.
We had a long list of TV to get through because I've got the very final episode of The Wire still to get to. And then The Mandalorian Season 2.
I have not watched The Mandalorian Season 2.
And soon Cobra Kai Season 3 is going to be out.
I'm telling
but
you.
But I will
Dad,
put
watch fucking
How to
John
with John Wilson.
Wilson
after that.
Watch How to with John Wilson before you watch whatever Cobra Kai is.
Cobra Kai was actually shockingly good.
I'm sure that it is. This show is about the human condition. And if you care about the human condition, like, I'm telling you, this is your life. Seeing New York City transform over the few months leading up to the pandemic is... I ended up both inspired and depressed in almost every single episode. And that is not... I never felt depressed by Ted Lasso. Maybe a little bit inspired at times. But
I felt very inspired.
But this was,
I was ready
like
to go be an EPL player.
Oh, you wanted to be a player, not a coach. Interesting.
Well, he was inspiring me.
You watched that. You
trying
said to yourself,
be Ted Lasso. I'm not saying I could. I'm just saying that's what I wanted
are,
to.
You were like, yeah, I could probably be a player.
Here's the question: Am I younger or older than the actor who played Roy Kent?
You're definitely older than Roy Kent was supposed to be as a player. It's probably supposed
I don't
to be
know
like
if I'm
35.
That. I mean, I guess he was going to play in MLS, so maybe not.
No, he was not going to play in MLS. He rejected that.
Well, he was. You're true. You're fair.
How old was Freddie Lundberg when he played in MLS?
Probably like 34.
You think it was only 34? Wow. God, imagine calling somebody old at 34. Kill me.
The actor who played Roy Kent is in fact older than me.
I think he was supposed to be a little bit younger, though. Anyway, How to with John Wilson was Cobra Kai level of inspiring, I suppose.
Well, Freddie Jungberg was much younger than I realized when he played for the Sounders.
Oh, God.
He turned 32 early in that first season.
Holy shit. We were like, old man Lundberg. Oh, Lord. Anyway, How to with John Wilson. So inspiring. And also is inspiring. The 2020 Seattle Seahawks. And
oh, wow.
I tell you, how many years have we been here and had Christmas ruined by the Seahawks team? And for once, I was looking back at the holidays, and I was like, what holidays did the Seahawks team ruined? And they definitely ruined Halloween, so that was something. But they managed in two games right around Christmas not to ruin either game. And that really is an inspiring thing.
I mean, they can't ruin New Year's because the game is a few days after New Year's, so they're fine now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about this finale.
Maybe it's the way the schedule works out, but I'm fascinated for week 17 at San Francisco in Arizona.
Yes, in Glendale, Arizona. The 49ers Their defense of the NFC Championship has been derailed by injuries. Of the 17 returning starters from the Super Bowl, 9 have spent time on IR, including Pro Bowlers Nick Bosa, George Kittle, and Richard Sherman. Just as they seem to be turning the corner with back-to-back wins during the Seahawks game in Week 8, Jimmy Garoppolo and Kittle got hurt in that game, and the 49ers then lost 6 of their next 7 games and were eliminated from the playoffs. They have been based in the Phoenix area since the start of December due to Santa Clara County's ban on contact sports. This will be their 4th game at State Farm Stadium in the last 5 weeks, including the road game against Arizona they won last Saturday. They beat the Cardinals 20-12 in Kittle's first game since the loss to the Seahawks, having entered that game 14th in DVOA, one spot behind Arizona. C.J. Beathard is the Niners' 3rd starting quarterback of the season. Jimmy G started 6 games before aggravating a high ankle sprain against the Seahawks and going on IR. Technically could return this week, but why? Backup Nick Mullins, who torched the Seahawks in the 4th quarter of the last meeting, suffered an injury to the UCL of his right elbow against the Cowboys, making Beathard the starter. He threw 3 touchdowns in a game where he wasn't asked to do a ton, going 13 of 22 for 182 yards. Beathard lost his only career start versus the Seahawks during his rookie season when he went 22 of 38 for 201 yards and an interception in a 24-13 Seahawks win back in 2017. On Saturday, Kittle was the only Niners receiver with more than 30 yards, catching 4 of 5 targets for 92 yards. His impact was also felt in the run game, where Jeff Wilson Jr. got a season-high 22 carries in his 4th career start and smashed his previous high with 183 yards. For the Niners as a team, was their first time over 200 rushing yards this season after 4 such games in 2019, including the NFC Championship game. With Kittle and Deebo Samuel in and out of the lineup, rookie Brandon Ayuk has been the 49ers' leading receiver with 60 catches for 748 yards. He has also run for 2 touchdowns. He had 8 catches for 91 yards and a TD against the Seahawks, most of those after Mullen took over late in the game. The Niners' defense held Kyler Murray to less than 5 yards per attempt and sacked him 3 times, tied for the most against Murray this season, albeit on a season-high 50 pass attempts. Defensive coordinator Robert Saleh has cobbled together a top 10 defense without the top 2 pass rushers, Bosa and Dee Ford. In their absence, Eric Armstead, who led the team last season with 10 sacks, hasn't had the same impact, but journeyman defensive end Kerry Hyder leads the team with 8.5 sacks. You'll recall he had 8 back in 2016 with the Lions, but just 2 combined the last 2 seasons as a reserve in Detroit and Dallas after an Achilles rupture in 2017.
Is that a callback to like a podcast from 2016?
You're damn right it is. Monday Night Football, we played the Lions. I remember writing about Kerry Hyder back then. The linebacker corps, the one place where San Francisco has stayed healthy. Fred Warner, their middle linebacker, earned a Pro Bowl nod. Kyle Juszczyk, the only other player on this year's roster to do so. Richard Sherman missed last week's game with a calf strain. Reclamation project Jason Verrett has emerged as a quality starter at cornerback on the other side.
And you go through all this, and if you were to tell me based upon what you're saying that the Niners were in the playoff hunt, I wouldn't be shocked by it, you know?
Like I said, they're 1 spot behind Arizona in DVOA.
I think it's interesting when you consider this team as a Super Bowl contender, they're a bad team. And when you consider this team as beating the Seahawks in week 17, they're a frightening team. And I think this is the type of game that obviously San Francisco has nothing to lose in the game. It's going to be, they're going to be go out there. They're just having fun, right? They want to beat the Seahawks. Possibly even more than the Seahawks want to beat them. And the other piece is that they have the talent to do so, right? Like, this is still, the bones are there of the team that went to the Super Bowl last year. And, you know, Kyle Shanahan is still there. This has been the type of team that has given the Seahawks a lot of trouble in the last few years, or all of Pete Carroll's tenure, especially when it gets to December and January. And a defense in particular, that you look at a top 15 defense from Robert Saleh, look, maybe it's not the Washington defense, maybe it's not the Saint or the LA Rams defense, not St. Louis somehow. But are they going
not for a long time?
Are they going to frustrate Russell Wilson? Are they going to annoy Russell Wilson? Absolutely they are.
I mean, I think the good news is they don't really fit the, you know, the platonic ideal of a team that frustrates the Seahawks, because they don't have much of a pass rush, as we talked about. And they're also a team that's really dependent on running the ball. So if the Seahawks can contain that running game and make CJ Beathard make plays, they're going to be in good shape.
Though.
They run the ball very successfully. I don't disagree with that. But what they want to do is similar to what the Rams want to do.
They run the ball very successfully to the edge, and they run misdirection extraordinarily well. They run receiver screens extraordinarily, or end arounds and stuff like that extraordinarily well. I think the speed of Jordan Brooks is going to be huge here.
Yeah.
And I think part of the reason that we saw, I think we probably talked about this. I was walking around Renton, Washington late at night with a congrats to Zach Whitman and you. Talking about why the Seahawks drafted Jordan Brooks, and that was to beat Kyle Shanahan and Sean McVay. We saw it one time already, but maybe we'll see it another time. And it's about having that speed at the linebacker position and a speed at the safety position from Jamal Adams, which is, are you turning these carries from Brandon Ayuk, from Deebo Samuel? Deebo should be healthy for this game.
You missed last week. I would be surprised if we played this week.
Okay. Will you look at the speed from the Brandon Ayuk's of the world? And is it a 12, 15-yard carry? Is it a 2-yard carry? And I think that was huge for them today against the Rams, and will be especially huge against San Francisco. Is it, are you turning Raheem Mostert? Are you turning Jeff Wilson? Are you turning these 49ers running backs?
Probably not Raheem Mostert.
But I'm saying in general, the 49ers running backs, are you turning, because it doesn't matter who it is. That's the thing about San Francisco, is people want to act like Raheem Mostert is a good running back, but what?
That's the thing about running backs.
Well, yeah, of course. But like, Jeff Wilson can out of nowhere run for 183 yards or whatever. Because the scheme makes it happen. And can the Seahawks stop that scheme? I think that they can, but we've seen them not do it over and over and over again.
We've seen them do it occasionally.
On the edge, they have not been great against these teams that want to go to the edge. But I think this year they've actually had their best success that they've ever had against teams like this. And
maybe 100%.
I think Jamal Adams has to be considered a part of it. You know, like having a healthy Jamal Adams against teams like this, and possibly Jordan Brooks should be part of it.
Should we talk about the Seahawks availability? We haven't mentioned thus far that Josh Gordon experienced, quote, setback in his conditional return to play and was unable to practice or play for the Seahawks. Unclear when or if that might change. Cornerback Quentin Dunbar set to go undergo season-ending knee surgery. Trey Flowers was not activated off IR after practicing last week. Probably will be this week, but no way at this point I think that he unseats DJ Reed at right cornerback, as well as Reed is playing. And then also Damon Stacks Harrison asked for his release after the return of Brian Monet at defensive tackle. He was set to be inactive this week. Lastly, right tackle Brandon Shell was active Sunday, but only in an emergency role, did not play. Cedric Ogbuehi got the start. I think we'll probably see Shell return to
good
the lineup
to see Brandon
this
Shell.
Sunday.
Been very impressive by DJ Reed, though.
Oh, he's been outstanding.
DJ Reed is, you know, you don't even remember that Quentin Dunbar is on the team. You don't remember that Trey Flowers is on the team, right? Like, what DJ Reed has done on the edge is near perfect. And, you know, Pete Carroll's talked about that. He's emphasized that. And I think Pete Carroll fucking loves to see a player like DJ Reed excel.
I mean, maybe you can make the case that the Seahawks could be better if they moved to DJ Reed inside in nickel situations and played Trey Flowers on the outside instead of Ugo Amadi at nickel. But I don't see any reason to mess with things at this point.
No. And we've not really seen Trey Flowers inside. Right, like
well, that's what I'm saying is you would probably play Trey Flowers outside and move DJ Reed to the slot in those situations.
I think it's working right now, and I don't think you mess with it defensively.
I agree. I'm just saying that's a consideration.
So, you know, they have the Seahawks. I'm going to do the most giant knock on wood here ever. For being week 17, this is a pretty healthy team. Yep. And getting Greg Olsen back in week 16, if you had told us that a couple weeks ago, we would have been quite surprised.
I mean, on that Thursday night, yeah, we would have been stunned.
So, you know, the fact that they're waiting on losing Dunbar for the year, it sucks, but, you know, he never really established himself here. And I think DJ Reed has even more, but getting Brandon Shell back is kind of the one last piece. They've got a lot of depth on the D-line. They're still waiting.
Well, they could get Daryl Taylor back at some point, yeah.
Getting Daryl Taylor back. Although, you know, Pete has been...
You know who, again, has flashed last week against the... Not last week, but against Alton the Rams Robinson. On Sunday. Alton Robinson.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, Daryl Taylor is a player who the Seahawks who felt like would have an impact on the season and has not played. Pete's been pretty down on his availability for Pete Carroll terms and saying that at some point he's just not going to come back this year. And I think if we're being honest, Gerald Taylor's not going to be part of this football team for the 2020-2021 season, which is fine. He doesn't need to be.
Even if he is able to practice at this point, like, you know, he hasn't played all year. He's a rookie. Like, what are you expecting?
Yes. This isn't, you know, when he was the second round pick that we were excited about back in April or whatever. It's
define we.
I think a lot of people were more excited about Daryl Taylor than they were about Jordan Brooks. But I also, you know, I like seeing Rashad Penny back and a pretty healthy team across the board. Like, the Seahawks are in a pretty good position here in a lot of different places. And obviously the Niners are not. I was surprised to see George Kittle come back.
Yes.
I don't. If you're asking me truthfully, I don't understand why. I don't get what the Niners gain by winning that game against Arizona. It's great. You got a moral victory, but every single win is hurting your draft capital. And the Niners are a team that needs draft capital right now. They're not the most deep young team in the league. And if they want to win, so be it, I suppose. But like, this is, it's both an old team and in a lot of ways, and an expensive team in a lot of ways. They're not built great. So the ideal scenario for them would be to have as much draft capital as they possibly can. And they're going to go in this game with a worse roster than the Seahawks are. I'm not as convinced that's the case with the Cardinals last weekend.
Chances of victory?
Well, again, I want to come back to that because I don't think it was
come back to that.
I don't think it was a huge upset when they beat the Cardinals in Arizona last week. I think the difference between talent is I don't think it's that great across the board.
I agree.
The rosters. But I do think with the Seahawks, it is the talent, the experience. I think it is a very big difference between, you know, where the Rams and the Seahawks are and where the Cardinals and the Niners are within the NFC West. I think there is a big drop off there. And, you know, we're always going to be scared of some of the players that are on the opposite sideline. But I do think the Seahawks have better, especially with the way that their defense has been playing, with having Russell Wilson. I think it's something like 68%, 72%. That's where I'm at. 72% chance of victory.
Okay. I'm going to go 65%. I mean, it would be exciting if they won 12 games. If they win this game, it will be the first time since they made the Super Bowl in 2014 that they have won 12 games.
Pretty wild. Really, when you think about it, you think about a 12-4 season. That's a great season. And you also think about the fact that one of those losses happened because Benson Mayo lined up over the center.
You also think that one of those losses happened against the New York Giants and Colt McCoy.
This is a 14-2 team that we're watching right here, and it's
I don't know if I go that far.
Well, also, I mean, the thing about when you're judging wins and losses is you assume that every loss, you go back and mitigate those games. But then you think back to the game against Dallas, against New England, against Minnesota.
The fact that they won on a fourth down and one stop against Cam Newton. Yes. Yeah, it wasn't a guaranteed thing. Not a sure thing.
All the wins that they ended up with, or whatever, like those plays, probably you can't get back, right? The fourth down completion to DK in the Minnesota game, the touchdown in the Minnesota game. So it probably ends up as a wash in the end. But like if the Seahawks are, if everything ends up as a wash and the Seahawks are a 12-14, there's a lot to feel really great about in that. You know, they leverage a lot to go out and get Jamal Adams, but the Rams did the same thing the previous year with Jalen Ramsey and they missed the playoffs. And this next year, the Rams will not be winning the NFC West. We have confirmed that that is not the case. And they expended the same amount of draft capital that the Seahawks did for Jamal Adams. And it's like, at some point, you just have to say to yourself, the Seahawks team is a good team. They are, their defense is playing well. They have a top 15 defense. They have a top, at their peak, they have a top 10 offense. Could the Seahawks make a run to the Super Bowl? I don't want to say that it's likely, but would I be shocked? Absolutely not.
No, we pivoted optimism here.
It's the best place to possibly be at the end of December as we're heading to the new year. You know you're going to host at least one playoff game, and what else could you be asking for at this point?
I mean, the best place to be would be in the driver's seat for the number one seed. That would be the best place to be.
There's only one number one seed, and look, we don't all get the fucking referees giving us every single call, let you line up on sides and they just say it's off sides. No, we get the calls where DK Metcalf is set and they still say he's not set. That's the kind of calls that we get. We do not get Green Bay Packer calls. We can't expect that to happen. We have to beat the Green Bay Packers on our own.
No, we have to hope that somebody else beats the Green Bay Packers.
We have to pray that somebody else beats the Green Bay Packers.
And we host the NFC Championship game as a result. That's the hope.
The Green Bay Packers, the refs, whatever, the weather in Green Bay, all things. But we are not the same. The Seahawks are a Martian, and that is why they have been so good for so many years. And ultimately, congrats to them for winning the NFC West, a feat that we should not take for granted. And I think as this emergency podcast ends, we have to be thankful once again for seeing Russell Wilson play football. Like this is not something that everybody gets to see every week. And I think about that constantly. So you could have fucking Jared Goff. You could go to a Super Bowl and you could have Jared Goff as your quarterback. You could have Jimmy Garoppolo as your quarterback. You could have any other quarterback around the league except for possibly Aaron Rodgers and Pat Mahomes. And you know what? It would feel terrible. And we get to watch Russell Wilson every single week represent us here in Seattle. And that is a beautiful thing.
On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.
I just want to say that Mrs. Fantasy Genius has got a lot of problem with literally you people. She felt like you were trying to kick her out of the Fantasy Football League. You didn't assign her a team, even though she played in the league last year and said that she wanted to play again this year. And so I had to give up my team to have her be part of the Pelton Cast Fantasy Leagues. And do you have an explanation for this?
No.
Oh, yeah, no, of course not. Many people are citing things like sexism, but we'll see. The main point that she wanted to make was she was on a revenge tour and singularly focused on executing revenge against you, of all people, despite the fact that you weren't even in the league.
Yes.
Her revenge.
Yeah, but there was a lot of revenge in that league because there was also a team named the Miyako's Revenge Tour because of my negative review of Miyako.
Revenge. The entire league was all revenge against you, and I really appreciate that. Fortunately, nobody. That's one thing. Like, you may have outplaced me in the Peltoncast MVP awards, which, by the way, can I just say right now? If I'm not seriously in consideration for the 2021, I suppose. I don't know when the voting happens. Spring.
I believe it's May traditionally.
I'm out there. Have you seen those tweets where it's like two different athletes putting up 20 and 20 or 40 and 20 or whatever? I'm out here every fucking week on this podcast dropping quadruple doubles, but you have nothing to say about that either. Just like you have nothing to say about Mrs. Fantasy Genius being frozen out of the fantasy league. So you stole my team. Gave yourself two opportunities to make the Champions League. You competed against the champions and didn't have what it took. You didn't. I was out there number one in points. I was, before this terrible Corey Davis performance tonight, was projected to score more points than the person who had Alvin Kamara on their team, right? Which, thanks to an amazing Mike Evans performance, looking good for winning the consolation bracket. But you gave yourself a second chance, right? Something that nobody else gets. Only you, of all people. Mrs. Fantasy
mostly
Genius.
Because people want to play against the listener wants to play against one of us in their leagues, I think.
Well, they didn't have the opportunity in the revenge.
The revenge league. Yes. It's officially
that
the
was
Pelton
just Cast. All about revenge league.
It's officially the Pelton Cast Super Bowl 48 champs. But not only did the Renton Revenge, Mrs. Fantasy Genius's team, make the playoffs, losing in the semifinals. Miyako's Revenge Tour made the finals, but sadly came up short. Rainier for life.
Teams, look, I gotta say,
well, I guess they still have two players left.
Strong energy when it comes to fantasy football.
They still have two players left, but they're down by 68 points to Rainier for life.
Josh Allen.
So, looks like Matt Smouse is probably going to pull this one off.
Anyway, Mrs. Fantasy Genius,
Josh Allen and Stephon Diggs. So if they have a huge game, it could happen.
That is not impossible. 68 points between Josh Allen and Steph. It's within the realm of possibility. But the Renton Revenge. But I love that both of the Revenge teams had to do with Renton too. Look,
it's true. Understandable.
We are spiteful people.
when are you a Rentonian? Your team isn't even named Renton in
I have lived there for like a decade plus. But once you went out there on this revenge tour.
You can take the boy out of Boulevard Park. You can't take the Boulevard Park out of the bar.
And made the playoffs in the Revenge League and now will be part of the Peltoncast Champions League, eliminating you from trying to squeeze her out of the league. I keep telling her this. I was like, you're in the Champions League. She's like, Kevin will find a way to get me out of it.
No, I will not. Well, we're here. Congrats to Chris Wheeler for winning the Peltoncast Champions League with Burger Napkin Taxonomy. Believe it or not, he had Alvin Kamara on his team.
I'm telling you, the team was beatable aside from Alvin Kamara. It was not a ridiculous performance.
In the Economist Friends League, I don't know if we have a final here. I know that Ben Baldwin was feeling much better. Yeah, each team still has one to play, so we don't have a final yet here between Appropriate Viscosity and Eric Manley and Ben Baldwin's Guga Ben. Ben currently leading by 5 points, given 95% chances of victory by ESPN because he has Josh Allen remaining, whereas his opponent has the Buffalo defense. So
okay, he's going to win.
seems very likely. Josh Allen seems very defense. Likely that he's going to win. That 43.2 from Devontae Adams was very solid, despite the fact that his opponent had Jeff Wilson. And that surprising 27.4 that we'll talk about later.
Well, I mean, I guess it is the Economist Friend League, so I support Ben winning.
So congrats to everyone who is a winner so far in the Peltoncast Fantasy Leagues.